Welcome to Everybody Hates Me, Let's Talk About Stigma, a podcast hosted by Dr. Carmen Logie. She's a Canada Research Chair in Global Health Equity and Social Justice with Marginalized Populations and an Associate Professor at the University of Toronto's Factor in Wintosh Faculty of Social Work. Every week, the show features amazing speakers from around the world talking about stigma from research, lived experiences, and activism perspectives. Why should we care about stigma? What can we do about it? Thank you for tuning in. Let's start the show.
Listeners, I am so excited today because I get to chat with an amazing researcher, colleague, and friend, Dr. Angela Kaida. She is the scientific director of the Canadian Institute of Gender and Health. She is a distinguished professor at Simon Fraser University in the Faculty of Health Sciences, and she leads a global research program focused on factors and environments that increase vulnerability or protect sexual and reproductive health, with particular attention to the context of HIV. We'll put a big bio of all of the other wonderful things you do. Welcome, Angela. How are you?
Good. Great. Thanks, Carmen. It's so good to be here with you.
I usually start the podcast by sharing how we met, but I think I feel like I've known you so long through GWOS. But I don't know if you remember the first time we met. I don't remember.
I mean, I also don't remember the very first time. It just feels like a relationship that has always been. But I know that you were at University of Calgary when we first met. So that just tells you how long ago it was.
2012.
Yeah. And because we're both women who grew up in rural Alberta, I remember hearing that about you and connecting with that right away. So maybe that's why I just feel like we have a similar.
Yeah, I'm rural Ontario, but it's close to rural Alberta.
Oh, I thought it was Three Hills.
I really think there's probably more similarities in rural Canada than differences.
Oh.
But I forgot that you were from Alberta.
Oh, yeah. I grew up grade 2 to grade 9 in St. Paul, Alberta, northeastern
wow.
Alberta. So yeah, we share a lot of things in common, but I always think that that's one of them.
Good food. We like good spots. Anyways, back to the podcast. So you're in Vancouver right now?
I'm in Vancouver right now. Yes.
Okay. I'm going to show up right now.
Okay.
And, you know, I'd really love to. It was so nice when I actually was there a couple of falls ago. I'm going to show up with my time machine. You know, it's been perfected. It's really COVID and other infectious diseases safe. It actually goes back and forth in time really nicely.
Okay.
It allows for multiple stopovers.
Okay.
So I want you to join me in this time machine and take me back to the time and place or times and places that really set you on the journey that you are on today, which is around challenging stigma, promoting human rights, you know, the focus on HIV. And remember, we could do multiple stopovers.
Yeah.
And multiple time zones.
So let's go to the late 1990s. I'm a teenager. We're probably teenagers. And and my family, I think you know, Carmen, that my family is from East Africa. So I'm born in Kenya, and we immigrated from Kenya to Canada when I was a small child. But I have a lot of family that still lives there today, and it's just been, it's a big part of my life. But in this time period, we know that HIV has already shown up in the U.S. and particularly in large cities, the both coasts of U.S. and San Francisco, New York. We're understanding that HIV is primarily an infection affecting gay men. And so we learn about it from that lens and the amazing activism and work of those communities. But actually, HIV was also ravaging communities in Eastern and Southern Africa, as we well know, and it looked very different in terms of who was being affected. And so for me, in your time machine, it shows up in my own family, where cousins, aunties, uncles of mine are living with HIV, and it's extremely scary for the family, and it's extremely, the stigma becomes overwhelming. And I have a wonderful family. I have a great family, an open family, talk about lots of different things. But this was so new, and this was so heavily stigmatized that we almost didn't have a language to speak about it. And that surprised me as a teenager, because I hadn't really encountered that in my family before, that we were able to really talk about difficult things. And here I saw people across the spectrum sort of twisting themselves in knots to talk about what this virus was and whose fault it was and how it came into the lives and what are the consequences, and just really twisting themselves up to find a language to talk about what was happening, which was really scary and really sad. And I would say, in your time machine, that was kind of my first exposure to health and stigma and the different ways that it shows up, depending on features of identity, power, privilege, all of those considerations. And one piece that I really saw was how women were being blamed in such deeply unfair ways for, quote, bringing HIV into the family, or the sexuality of women being really policed and monitored and commented on, and without the same scrutiny to men. And so I was pretty angry about this, is the best way I can describe it. Confused and very angry. I don't think I had the language of, you know, stigma and power and oppression. I didn't have that language yet. And so I would say that, whether I knew it or not, that probably planted the first seeds of where my research kind of contributions have led me to today, is really around the experience of HIV for women is such a different experience than the stories that we were initially hearing. Not better, not worse, not any, it's just very different. And I think the ways that they intersect with our identities as caregivers, as, you know, mothers, as parents, really complicates the story of HIV, which is really what took me down a pathway of being interested in sexual and reproductive health and HIV.
Wow. So the story is a while ago, and kind of moving between Alberta and Kenya. So interesting. And I remember myself, when I first started volunteering in an AIDS floor, it was called AIDS floor in 94. And what you said was very right. There's just a lot of stigma, a lot of fear, you know, isolation of people. And at that time in Toronto, where I was living, most of the people were men on the ward. But whenever there was a woman, there was just a lot more scrutiny and just a lot more surprise. Like, it wasn't really expected, or people weren't really used to seeing at that time, you know, in Toronto, at least, women living with HIV. So it did feel like you were just more used to seeing men, and, you know, and it was in, you know, what was then Wellesley, the gay village. So there was a sort of more question marks, or more, I think, just attention to maybe blaming or just wondering, why did this person do?
Yeah, you know, what went wrong? You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So I usually just like ask three questions for podcast listeners. You, if you've heard before or not heard before, pretty casual, but I really want you to tell us, you know, it's 2023. Why should we still care about this topic, stigma, HIV, women, sexual reproductive health? Like, aren't we over this by now? Like, what's the big deal?
Yeah. I just love this question, because it's such a, like, it's kind of like we're used to defending our work so passionately, and it just sort of helps us sort of step back out again about, like, okay, wait, but like, what's the big picture here? And I think the question of stigma is as relevant as ever. And it's just such a remarkable part of the history of HIV research, policy, programming, which is that, you know, scientists and community leaders and doctors and nurses and clinicians have collectively changed what it means to live with HIV in terms of your health and your survival, right? Like a person living with HIV who's diagnosed today can expect to live, you know, a life expectancy that is almost the same as an HIV negative person. Access to treatment is not universal, but is very widely available around the world. There's pockets of inequity, but generally speaking, this has been a remarkable global public health success. And in such, some would argue, like quite a short period of time from discovery of this as a novel virus to where we are today. And so I don't know that I can think of another virus that has had that trajectory of prevention strategies, treatment strategies, you know, messaging campaigns, etc. But the thing that hasn't changed is the stigma associated with the disease, which is just unbelievable. Maybe, okay, for folks like you who are deep experts in stigma-related research, maybe it's not unbelievable, but it's just a real disappointment that how we started the narrative of HIV, because our sex lives are implicated, because other behaviors that may be taken up around substance use, et cetera, might be implicated, the stigma just can't seem to be shaken from HIV. And it's unfair, but it's not just a feeling of stigma. That stigma has serious consequences, life and death consequences, for so many people all around the world. So what we need to do to address stigma remains almost like maybe even more relevant than it used to be, because we do have treatments and we have prevention strategies, et cetera. And we haven't really made a dent in the stigma part of this story.
Yeah, I agree with you. And in some cases, I mean, I kind of like to say, and people may have heard me say this before, but I think that a big part of the issue is we still stigmatize sex and we're living in a sex negative world. You know, although there are proponents of sexual pleasure and the pleasure project, and we're trying to get there in your own work. I know has an Ali Carter, you've talked about sexual pleasure and it's so amazing, and sexual satisfaction in general. I don't see the same changes when it comes to discussing sex in a positive way and assess sex like not associated as something risky and dangerous and, you know, immoral. I feel like we're still stigmatizing sex, you know, and we're stuck there.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And sometimes I feel like maybe we've even gone backwards. Like it's partly our contribution as public health people, because when we talk about sex, the only time people hear public health, population health researchers or experts talking about sex, it's all of the ways that it's a problem, all the ways in which it causes you to experience bad things, right? An unintended or unwanted pregnancy, a sexually transmitted infection, HIV acquisition, sexual violence. Like it's all of the ways in which sex shows up in our lives and is is a negative, we experience negative consequences. And we just don't talk about the ways in which sex shows up in our lives and is amazing and has wonderful consequences, even though as just general people, we know that to be the case. So it's this experience of like our lived and living experience, quote unquote, is just out of like sync with the ways in which we're professionally talking about sex.
It's so true. Okay, I want to ask you the next stigma question.
Yeah.
And I know that you've been making guidelines and recommendations, so maybe that could also be relevant to thinking through this. So what I wanted to ask is, in your experience and your research and your activism, what does it look like, you know, maybe in a day-to-day experience of someone you're working with, maybe a woman living with HIV in Canada? I know that's a focus of your work. How does stigma sort of show up and interrupt or shape a day in the life? Maybe as a person living with HIV or just a person not living with HIV, how might stigma regarding sexual health or HIV show up, you know, somebody walking maybe around your neighborhood or walking around Vancouver?
Yeah. Well, so maybe I'll share the story this way, but I think, you know, I'm not living with HIV just as a researcher, and I try to be very upfront about that. And my work is about, a big part of my work and my practice is around what does it mean to practice allyship with particularly women living with HIV, because that's the focus of my work. But what does it mean to practice allyship? And I think in terms of stigma, it shows up in a few obvious and then a few insidious ways. And so because I'm so used to talking about HIV and sexual and reproductive health, and I have many colleagues and friends and family who are living with HIV, I can lose sight of the ways that folks who are not in this space may perceive us and the work that we do. But sometimes we'll experience these moments of, we want to book a conference room, or we want to book a restaurant booking, and it's for the Women in HIV research program, and facing questions and stigma and like additional attention and scrutiny because of the research group that we're bringing forward.
Wow.
I have to say, like, every time that happens, I'm not inoculated to this. It genuinely knocks me back. And so I bring that into my practice of allyship of like, oh my God, what, you're like such a privileged life. Like, all you're trying to do is book, you know, like, I don't have to confront this as a patient, as a woman, you know, seeking housing, or I don't have to confront this in my life. So what does it mean to practice allyship in these moments of stigma? I see it show up in ways in which when we're trying to recruit women to participate in studies. And women who'll come to these spaces and they'll say, oh my gosh, I've actually never met another woman living with HIV before. I've been living with HIV for like 20 years. I didn't know that we had, like, there were this many women living with HIV in BC or in Canada. I just didn't know that this community exists. And I've been, I've really isolated myself and kept myself. So you kind of, you're like, oh my goodness. So stigma shows up in all of these such insidiously isolating ways. And I try to think about it across our research kind of program, all the way from like, how do we talk about our research in ways that doesn't put women at increased risk of stigma and discrimination? You know, how do we create environments where if we're recruiting women into these spaces, that they can trust that their information will be held confidential, that the spaces that we're creating for this research are safer. I can never really say safe, but are safer. Are we're all on journeys of reconciliation, and how do I sort of, myself and my team, what kind of training do we undergo to be active in that work? And so I think of us, and even, you know, in our survey design, our focus group discussion design, our whatever data collection instruments that we're creating, I think we can show up in those tools all the time. And
such a good point.
And it does, right? It's like, how did you get HIV? I remember the first time I asked that question, and I just got, like, the women on our team were like, that question is so inappropriate. And I got fully schooled, dressed up, dressed down around why, what the problem is with a question like that, what it assumes about the person in front of you. The expectation of opening up wounds of trauma for the purposes of a research exercise, like just that constant reflexive work, that stigma is not just something that exists of other people doing, you know, bad things to people I care about, but it's everywhere. It's embedded across our research enterprise, and really how to be open, you know, humble enough and open enough to receive the feedback of where it is, and be reflexive around our own roles in propagating stigma, even if that's not our intention.
Those are such good points. And I really like this focus. I know I've learned a lot about how to better acknowledge stigma in people's lives in the way that we think about doing the research as well. Like, I remember there's one of the podcasts that the listeners are interested with, Yasmin Prasad, and we had done a program called Transcending Love with trans women of color.
Okay.
And I just had assumed giving tokens for the public transit would, this is typically what we did, you give tokens. And thanks to Yasmin and the other community board members on our project, we're like, it's not actually safe for trans women of color to ride public transit. Mm-hmm. Like, you actually need to give people money for Uber. You just can't assume people's safety in the transit system, which is typically just, you know, being in social work, you're going to come for health or social services, or we just have a roll of tokens for the transit. And just really being aware, like, actually, there's so much stigma, people don't ride the transit.
Right.
You know, and like, to think about that, you know. And I remember one project a long time ago, I hope I've learned since then, but I'm obviously still learning every day. You know, it was with the Women's Community-Based Research Project, like a long time ago, with like Wangari Thoreau, Mona Lutfi. You know, we'd pay people money to participate in focus groups, women living with HIV. And one woman who was very underhoused didn't have anywhere to put the money.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have a solution, you know, other than to put a note that was so big, she was worried that people wouldn't take the note. It was a $50 note. Mm-hmm. She just looked at me and was like, where am I going to put this? And no one's going to accept it from me. And then since then, I never have given, because I just mm-hmm. didn't realize it, with my own power and privilege, that, mm-hmm. oh, some people will not take a $50 note from them. Some people just don't have a purse or a bag or anything. So it really shifted me being like, oh, I really, you know, for me, I mm-hmm. actually did that also because of safety reasons, because carrying mm-hmm. smaller bills at night for 12 to 15 people plus money for, it means I'm also carrying a huge wad of cash as a woman alone. And, you know, and I didn't feel safe with this huge, but that's also a stigma that women face, right?
Or oh, yeah.
feminine presenting people like at night. So it's just like so complicated, right? So I was like, well, I have less of a huge amount of cash if I have like less bills to carry, you know, but then that is downloaded that risk onto people who are so marginalized, right? So it just, you know, it's just very thinking about stigma and all these intersections of like poverty stigma and homeless stigma and trans stigma and racism, you know, it's complex.
It's complex. But I think it's such a great example, Carmen, because it's like sometimes we're better at talking about the big forces of stigma and the big structural ways that these forces of oppression sort of show up, and a little bit less willing to examine the ways in which they show up in our day to day, which is why I like that question so much. There's no being above it or outside of it or beside it or in front of it. Like we're in it. It's a soup and we are, you know, we're in it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that as, you know, as researchers, as people practicing allyship, as scientists, being able to see ourselves as like part of that soup, I don't know if soup is a great analogy,
yeah.
but as like part of it, we're flavoring
the water. We're part of the water.
We're flavoring it, right? we're drinking it, we're flavoring it, we're doing all of the things. It's actually a really important part of our practice. Needs to be a really important part of our practice, because otherwise our work is very externalizing. It's like other people need to do better at other things, etc. And there are lots and lots of ways for us to recognize, address, you know, be mindful of the ways in which stigma shows up close, very close to us, and the ways that we propagate it and the ways in which, you know, what are the practices that we can take up to do something about it. And I find that's been such an important part of our research too, because it can start to feel very overwhelming. Like the problems just feel so big and so out of our control and so like, you know, we need to address poverty. Like it's like, you know, like,
right.
But there are, so bringing back to the things that, you know, we can actually do day to day, still working on these big structural forces, but, you know, still grounding ourselves in the ways in which stigma shows up and where and how we can act.
Yeah, that's such a good point. You know, I think with the next question, it really actually ties into your guidelines and your recommendations, which is, what can we do about it? I mean, I guess it's what we were just talking about, being aware of it and aware of our own blind spots. You know, I wrote this book. I actually learned a lot writing it, but one of it was on like the idea of these like epistemologies of ignorance is like, we have to know what we don't have to know because of our privilege. So like, you know, white people don't necessarily need to know about racism because we don't experience, or straight people don't really need to know about homophobia because they don't experience. So just, you know, to our last point, like, why don't we be aware of what we don't know about because we don't have to, you know, like those stigmas. But I was just wondering if you could, if someone's listening to this podcast, walking their dog, or, you know, maybe walking on the lake, maybe walking down the street, maybe riding a bus, like what can they do? Or what do you, what have you been thinking? Because I know you're making like guidelines and things like that.
Yeah. Well, if I can just share. So a part of the process that what we've been working on is that the World Health Organization released this document, which was a consolidated guideline on sexual and reproductive health and rights of women living with HIV. Mm-hmm. It was like back in 2017. And they kind of said to countries around the world, like, hey, like figure out on your country level, like, what are you going to do about this? And one thing that was kind of exciting for us is that for the first time, the World Health Organization worked in collaboration with women living with HIV to develop these guidelines. I'm like, oh my God, okay. So this is the model that we espouse. And so let's take this up in Canada. And so we've taken, you know, we've been on this long journey since then with international webinar series, a whole bunch of, you know, in-person events to develop, okay, for Canada, what can we recommend in terms of how do we advance sexual reproductive health and rights of women living with HIV in our setting? How do we use the best evidence that we have about women and sexual reproductive health and rights? How do we look at best practices, like which groups are doing what that we can kind of scale up and support across the country? And really, what are a set of principles for us? Like, how do we want to do this work? And so we put forward and published this last year around these five recommendations. And a very interesting thing that emerged, at first I thought we might be moving in a direction of like, for pregnancy planning, here are the recommendations. For contraceptive uptake, here are the recommendations. But that's really not how the recommendations evolved. And really what they centered on was, how do we create enabling environments that collectively support the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women living with HIV? And I thought this was amazing, like as a conversation, a national conversation of lots of different stakeholders in this space, that the focus was, we can get there in technical terms of how to support, you know, different contraceptive decision-making, as an example, how to support safer disclosure, as an example. But we need enabling environments for us to take this up in an equitable way. And so I guess a basic principle of these recommendations is that we need these environments to be actively fighting stigma.
Yeah.
And there are ways, different ways that we can do that. And so just as an example, like the first recommendation, I just want to get it exactly right. It's like, it's not going to surprise anybody, but the number one recommendation is that we have to meaningfully engage women living with HIV across research, policy, programming, and this needs to be inclusive to the diversity of experiences and identities of women living with HIV in Canada. So I put that forward as a recommendation, and you know, you and lots of listeners would be like, obviously, like, you know, you didn't need to do this whole thing to come to that as a conclusion. Definitely agree with that. But the next steps of what that is how do you do that? Mm-hmm. And so the work that we put forward was like, here are some of the groups across the country that are doing this in very, in meaningful ways, in effective ways, in profound ways. And groups that are doing, they're taking on this challenge as their own learning, their own work, building their own capacity so that they can create spaces that are safer for women living with HIV to engage with. I think that shift in thinking that it's like the work is not only on women living with HIV.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, most of the work needs to be on those of us who are practicing allyship, need to do a better job practicing allyship.
Yes.
To generate these safer environments. And I'm thinking a lot about the burden of expectation for on marginalized communities, underserved communities, of like the additional labor that we just continue to place on them to fix the conditions that are not created by them.
Totally.
By us. I mean, many of us wear a number of hats in this way. And so for me, the focus of these recommendations on these enabling environments represents, I think of it as like a calling in of all of us, not a calling out, but a calling in of all of us to say, we create these environments, which means we can change these environments to advance these goals that we all think are really important to advance. And so the record, I won't go through it. I can provide everyone with this link, but I think.
Yeah, put the link, definitely.
But the recommendations really stem from that thinking. And they're very actively anti-stigma. They're very actively, you know, anti-racist. They're very actively anti-oppression in their conceptualization and their practice. And they're very action oriented. Like, we can't just sit around feeling bad about this, this is too bad. No, there's work to be done, and we can, all of us have a role to play, and we can do it.
I love that. And also it reminds me when you said that the work is on the people who are offering or wanting to offer services, resources, and all of that, because not to like talk about the book I wrote, but the point of the book was to challenge the idea that people are hard to reach. Nobody is hard to reach if they're your friend.
Mm-hmm.
People are only hard to reach because you don't know them. They don't know you, and you're not friends with them. They don't know your friends. So for me, it's like, why is what you said, the burden of people all like, I want to go and do research with X community, but they're hard to find.
Well, no,
you're hard to find. You haven't made, you haven't entered other people's worlds, or you haven't opened your world up to like be inclusive of the people that you want to work with or you want to connect with.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that focus on the environment and what you said, we're always creating this, the environment, and either that's an environment that is actively working on what you said, allyship and anti-racism, anti-oppression in all its forms, and trying to connect with people, or we're just sitting there like waiting for people to find us, you know, being like, they're so hard to find, and we're like, you're just like, they're so hard to reach, and you're just sitting there in your office at the university, you know, just like, oh, so hard to find some people, you know. Well, maybe it's, they're not allowed on your campus, you know.
Exactly. Like, they're not allowed on your campus. You're like, oh, I put it on my social media post. It's like, okay, let's try a bit harder than that. And I think because it demands something of us that's different as researchers, right? It demands, you know, like a bit of a vulnerability. It demands a showing up for the community that you're supposed to serve. And in a way that is, you know, maybe it's unfamiliar. I'm not saying that I'm great at it. It's unfamiliar. It's makes you feel vulnerable.
It's a humility, really, that you actually are the one that has to change and to be aware of your biases and why are you not in touch with certain people?
And why are you not? Yeah. And why do certain people not want to be found by you?
Why don't you know some people?
Right? Like that's the flip side of that conversation. You can't find people, but maybe people don't want to be found by you. And that requires some real reflection and
exactly.
Then effort, you know, and you and I both know that like the number of research publications that have a limitation section of, oh, you know, we overrepresented, you know, white, cis, straight, you know, highly educated people in our sample, so it might not be generalizable to other groups. It's like, okay, I think we've saturated that as a research finding and limitation by this stage of the game. And it's incumbent on all of us to not feel okay with that as a conclusion, as a limitation, right?
Totally. Okay, you're awesome. And I know we're almost at time, but I wonder if we can do a few wild cards. Quick wild card questions.
Let's do it.
Where the listeners get to know the real you.
Oh boy.
Okay. All right. First wild card. What are you watching on Netflix, Crave, Hulu, Disney Plus? What are you watching?
Okay. So, I live with preteen and teenage boys. Okay, so I just need to tell you that I have to watch a lot of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which...
I've actually heard good things about that from Dr. Alex McClelland. I have heard Brooklyn Nine-Nine is good.
Okay. I find it extremely hilarious and not at all taxing on my energy. So I have to say that I am not currently, because you know I've just started this new position, so I have very little bandwidth for new and thought-provoking entertainment materials. You know what I mean, right?
I completely know what you mean. I only watch Drag Race. That's like the only thing I watch. And Cesar Millan, better dog. That's all I watch. I don't even want to watch White Lotus. I don't know. It sounds so stressful. I don't want to watch anything stressful.
Want to watch anything stressful in any way. And I don't want to watch anything unpredictable. Yeah, my emotional state is a bit vulnerable. So that's the best I could say about...
I need to watch it. Two recommendations on this podcast. Okay. That's great. Two recommendations. I'm totally going to watch it. Okay. Next wild card.
Yeah. Ready.
You can go anywhere in the world with anybody, mm-hmm. living or dead, mm-hmm. for dinner, lunch, a cocktail. Where do you go and who do you take?
Okay. Where do I go and who do I take? Oh, okay. So where do I go? I think I go probably, so, you know, I love East and Southern Africa as destinations. And I think everyone knows that I have lived in Durban for a while and I love it there. And so I just love it there.
It's beautiful.
I would definitely go to Durban with this person because for lots of different reasons, I think there are questions of inequity and solidarity and resistance that come from that place that I just love to think about and talk about and experience. If I could go with anybody, who would I go with? So I'm going to have to say, so I have a namesake. So Angela Davis is my namesake, which is like very, and she, this is a long, amazing story, but she escaped the U.S. in the 1970s to Tanzania, which was where my parents were going to university at University of Dar es Salaam and came and gave, you know, a thing they had just it was post-independence in Tanzania, a very kind of quite socialist government, and come there and enthralled both of my parents, who they met, and that's how they named me. And I have since just obviously read everything that she writes and talks about, and I just think to be there with her in this moment,
right,
of the conversations that we're currently having, the work that she put forward, like, I don't know, like 40 years ago, that we're kind of taking up under the banner of intersectionality, but just so much of what she had been talking about at the time.
Oh.
I just would love to know how she thinks about the progress that we've made or not made, and the language that we're using versus the language that she had put forward such a long time ago, in a different time. That's my answer.
That's an awesome answer.
Yeah. Coming to me. I wasn't like, oh, in my life, I would love to. No, but.
That's cool. Okay, the very, very last question before I let you go is there any advice, words of wisdom, quotation that has guided you that you wanted to share with the listeners?
I have a thing that I think about a lot, which is not particularly profound, but comes up for me a lot, where it's just a line that's like, you're always with you. And it's not that profound, but it's a good grounding for me in that there's no escaping. You're like, oh, I'm going to go on vacation. When I'm on vacation, I'm going to be like this totally different person. And I'm going to do that. It's like, no, it's still you. It's still you. And that can be a threat. Right. Like sometimes I think about that thing as a threat, and sometimes I think about it as a comfort, right? When you have to go through difficult things and you've got to do things that are challenging for you, you know, in my moments of confidence, I'm like, that's a comfort. It's still you, you know, you're still going to bring who you are to this space and, you know, just relax into that understanding. And then sometimes it's a threat. Like it's still you. Like, you're not going to miraculously become a better, smarter, you know, more insightful, compassionate person just because you're in a different space. It's still you.
I love that. So, it's so good. Right. And you can change, right?
You can change.
Yeah.
And you can change, but being you know, you're on your journey, whether it's a professional journey or a personal journey or relationship or intimacy or whatever, where you're just bringing this same person with all the warts and, you know, all the like bells and everything to those spaces. And how do you get, you know, how do you find some comfort in that? And how do you create, you know, how do you, I try to figure out for myself, like, how do I enter spaces where that whole self is welcome? Like, I don't have to do the compartmentalizing that so many, that's just demanded of so many of us. And so how do I bring my whole self into these spaces? And I'll say Indigenous colleagues and friends have really taught me a lot about that. And I've been forever grateful, but I guess that's my, like I said, it's not profound, but I always think about it. I always, always think about it.
I think it's very profound. And it reminds me of something someone told me last week, just in the way that I think something about you're always with you is like, you can't escape it. It's ongoing. It's lifelong. Someone last week said the paint is always wet. Like, we're always progress, right? We're always in progress. So
yeah,
I love that. Thank you so much for joining our podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, Carmen. That was so fun. And as always, it's like, can't wait to pick up on this conversation.
Yes. I'll see you soon. And thank you so much again. And for listeners, I'll have a link to Dr. Kaida's amazing work, these recommendations and everything. So thank you again.
Okay. Take care. Thanks, Carmen.
Thank you for listening to Everybody Hates Me. Let's Talk About Stigma, a podcast hosted by Dr. Carmen Logie. Join us for more inspiring and motivating conversations with stigma leaders from around the world.